going to have an interesting program this morning, and it's going to be about life lessons I learned from the dead. Our guest is Margo Lindmark. Margo has journeyed far from her Midwestern roots to live a life of service to others. She has taught transcendental meditation in U.S. corporations as well as in Egypt, India, Philippines, Czech Republic, and Slovakia. Before alternative medicine was in vogue, she managed an Ayurvedic health center in Palm Beach, Florida, and also a rock band. I'm going to have to ask her if that was at the same time. She is a relationship coach, an author, an artist, and a public speaker, and as a profession, she's a realtor in the mountains of Boone, North Carolina, where she currently resides. Good morning, Margo.
Good morning, Wynn. How are you?
Great. The subtitle of your book, Light in the Morning, is Memoirs of an Undertaker's Daughter. So, did you grow up in a funeral home?
I grew up around a funeral home. We didn't live in it like some people do. We had our own home, but I'd always meet my father after school or after church or something like that at the funeral home, and he'd give me a ride home. So I ended up spending a lot of time in the funeral home.
So why did you write this book?
Well, that's a really good question. I was really prompted by many of my friends to write this book because I've had many people come back to me after they've died and given me very clear messages about life. And I can tell you I think they're important messages for people to hear, but the reason I actually wrote the book, I actually did it, was because when my brother died, I needed this book. I needed not only inspiration, but I needed some very deep understanding about life and death. And I felt like if I didn't get something really deep from this, I didn't know how I was going to get over the grief of losing him. So that's what really prompted the book.
Well, I'll go back to the story of your brother in a second, but do you consider yourself a medium or a channel?
No, not really. It's my understanding that a medium is someone who can contact anybody that you want them to contact. My experience has been these people have come to me, and it's been very innocent and not prompted or anything. They've just come to me in different ways, dreams and other ways. And so it's nothing that I actually even have any control over. They just come to me, and they visit me in a visitation in a dream or something. So I don't consider myself a medium at all. A channel, I'm not sure what the difference is, but I do very clearly have communication with these people. But it's not on command, if you can see the difference.
Well, I'm a channel. I channeled my book, Freedom from Addiction, in a dream where God laid out the book for me and then wrote it. So in that sense, I'm a channel. So I suppose that anybody who talks to or takes advice from or learns from and then writes about it, people on the other side or God or whatever, that they're channels. For what that's worth, I don't know.
Well, that's really interesting. So, I mean, maybe I am, because in a way, you're speaking to that person and they're not physically in front of you. So maybe that's what channeling is. I've never really thought about it too much, but maybe that is what that is. I'm not sure. But if you did that and they came to, you know, all of that came to you in a dream, that's how these people kind of came to me too, in a dream. And it was a very clear communication. So maybe so.
There's different ways of being a channel. I remember that my ex-wife did automatic writing, and she would sit down and put her mind at rest, and then her hand would just start writing, and she'd start channeling from somewhere, some person or whatever like that. So I suppose that you can get your channel open in various ways, but it's a really interesting thing to study and to see, because we're limited to our five senses. Metaphysically, there's more out there than that. And there's everything that you've ever wanted to know has already been told. But how you're going to get to that information is the important thing. Well, let's get back to your story. Your brother died. Is that something that you want to talk about during this interview?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'll talk about anything you want to talk about. Uh-huh.
Well, tell me the story.
Okay. Well, okay. It's a long story, so I'll keep it short. But it was a surprise when he died. He wasn't sick. I just got the news, and everybody was shocked. He was that kind of personality that was never going to die. You know what I mean? Just so full of life and so much charisma and so much going on in his life that he was just never going to die. And so when he did, it was really a shock. And my brother and I were like, if there's such a thing, Wynn, as a twin soul, or if there's, you know, something like that, you know, you hear these terms, he was probably it for me. We were so much alike. We were so close. And so when he died, it had a very, very, very deep effect on me. And I went inward. I just really sort of dropped everything I was doing for a little while and just went inward. And I thought, whatever comes out of this will be my living memorial to my brother. And the book is what came out of it. Because years ago, about 10 years ago, when my father died, someone said I should write his story. And I thought, well, I'm not going to write his story. You just asked me, and I told you, you know. So I had no intention of writing a book. But then when my brother died, I thought, okay, here comes the book, because I needed it. I needed this book. I needed this understanding, that all of it that came to me. And so that's what I'm hoping everybody else will get, too. I can tell you, you know, lots of different parts of the story about my brother. I don't know how deeply you want me to go.
Well, I guess the important thing is you were very close, and you went through a period of grieving, and in that grieving, it came to you that part of your life purpose was spreading this message about death?
About life and death, yes, uh-huh. Because it's really a book about grieving. It's a book about people who have died and have come back to me with their very important messages. But the important thing is their messages. So it's really a book for people. It'll help people grieve, for sure. I've had many people call me, you know, look me up online and call me and grieve with me. You know, I mean, I grieve with them. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of people, which has been really fulfilling. But it's really, you don't have to be grieving to get something out of this book, because isn't that just what we want, is for these people to come back and tell us what's really important about life? And each one of these deaths of people close to me, they've come back and told me what's important about life. And it's not always, you know, what you expect to hear. With my brother, it wasn't what I expected to hear. But every time I heard one of these messages, because it was from that level of truth, it changes you. I changed instantly as soon as they told me that. Something in me changed, and I changed how I lived my life, which is pretty interesting, you know.
So what's the bottom line from your brother? What message did he give you?
Yeah, okay. So from my brother, it was an interesting process, because I realized at some point that he didn't realize he was dead. He didn't realize he was gone. And this happens a lot with people. You know, they drop the body. The body just falls off like you take off your coat and drop it on the ground. You know, it's kind of like that, but the soul moves on. The soul is still very much alive. And he died so quickly, he just didn't realize he was not in the body. And so I had to tell him that. And so I did. And when I told him that, I could feel him as I was saying, "Mike, you're no longer in the body. We've had your funeral. You've died, and this is why you see me crying all the time, but you're no longer in your body. You are on the other side. You have died." And I could hear him hearing that. I could hear it making sense to him on the other side. And after I told him that, he was coming to me every night before that in dreams. Every single night since he died, he was coming to me in dreams. And after I told him that, he never came to me in a dream again. He knew. He heard it. It was really, really interesting and really devastating, you know, because then he was kind of gone. But and it's a really interesting story. I went on a shamanic journey to find him. And I can go into that if you'd like to, but I'll tell you what his message was. He came after he didn't show up in my dreams anymore. It was about a year later, which was right around the anniversary of his death. He did come to me in a dream. And I was so excited. And in a dream, I'm like, "Mike, oh my God." And I just was talking a mile a minute. I was so excited. And I said to him, "Mike, when do I get to be with you again?" And he said to me, "It's not about that. It's not about being with me again. It's about how you are with whoever you are with." And then I woke up.
So, philosopher.
Well, it was so interesting, Wynn, because it's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear I'm going to be with him, not soon. I don't want to die soon or anything, but I'll be with you as soon as you come over, or I'll be back. Or I just wanted to hear something different than that. But here's what it did to me. It made me be in the moment with whoever I am with. I was yearning to be with my brother again somehow. And that message automatically changed me. And I realized that whoever, you know, it's kind of like love the one you're with. That was pretty much the message. Just really, truly be with that person and give it your all. And it's how you're being with that person that counts. Isn't that interesting? It changed me. It really changed me. I appreciate everybody I'm with now, you know, and I'm not quite as attached either, because I realize that a lot of people come and go. Right now I'm with you and we're having a great conversation. And this right now is what's important. We have each other in front of our eyes in a sense, and we're the ones that are supposed to give each other attention right now. And so we are, and that's what's really important. When we get off this call, you're going to go talk to somebody else. I'm going to go see somebody else. It'll be them. So it's really a be here now and love the one you're with kind of message, which is really important.
I have an interest that has spanned a number of years about near-death experiences, about the people who died and then came back, and what they had to say about when they were out of their body and everything. Did he give you any message along those lines?
He did not. Nope, he didn't tell me what he was doing. He came to me, and he was in about his, I would guess, he looked exactly like he did in about his mid-30s, something like that, when you're at your prime, just this, you know, handsome face, big smile. He was doing really, really well. But no, he didn't tell me anything about that. Nothing.
Okay. Well, now, you say that you have gotten messages from people who died, and I'm quoting you when you said, "Death speaks to me." Is that what you meant when you said that? Death speaks to me?
Yeah, pretty much. I almost named my book that, Death Speaks to Me. and the way it speaks to me is because through death, I have these deep messages or deep insights. So somehow, death becomes the way I really learn about life. And so that's why I said death speaks to me. I like that phrase, and it almost became my title because I think it's interesting, yeah. You know, other people have other things that speak to them, but death speaks to me.
Okay. So,
but it's not morbid.
So you've had more than one person that came to you, and I assume that it's mainly in dreams. Tell me an interesting story.
Okay. When my father died, and this is the first time someone said I should write the book, when my father died, my father was pretty exceptional, I have to say. If there's anyone enlightened on the planet these days, it was my father. You know, he showed it in every word and deed that he did, that kind of sums it up. And he was a funeral director, and people really, really loved talking to my father because somehow he had this way about him and this aura about him that was very compassionate and loving and deep and insightful, and I really feel like he was very enlightened. So, and his actions proved it out through his whole life. So when he died, I couldn't get to him. He died in Kansas City. I was in Iowa, and I couldn't get to him because there were big snow and ice storms going on, and I couldn't get to the funeral home for 5 days. The funeral director kept saying, don't come. We don't want you to end up like your dad. You know, it's very dangerous here right now. And so it was 5 or 6 days later that I finally got to go in and see him. And I was a little worried. Someone told me, don't view the body because it'll have decayed by now. You know, the man who bought the funeral home for my father told me that. Don't view the body at this point. But I'll tell you, when I wanted to see his face, I had to see my father's face. So when I walked in that room, you know, we went through the funeral home. We go down this long hallway, and he opens the door, and I see this gurney at the end of this big room, this long room. So I felt like I went into another dimension or something. I just felt mesmerized when I walked into that room. It felt like slow motion. And I walked over to the gurney, and I asked the funeral director if I could have a stool because it was, you know, about eye level to me almost, and I needed to see him. And I stood up on this stool and looked down at his face, and I just started weeping for joy. The tears were just pouring down my face, and I look at him, and I go, Dad, yes, yes. And the funeral director must have thought I was crazy, but I saw in his face, I saw every single action of his life add up to his moment of death. And I saw it all in his face. And what I got from it, it was the most beatific. I mean, keep in mind, I've seen a lot of dead bodies. I grew up in, you know, around a funeral home, so I just saw body after body. I've never, ever seen this look in someone's face. There was light coming off his face, about a foot off his face. And he had the most beatific look on his face that I have ever seen. I've never seen anything like it. And what I got from him was that at every given moment, we have the choice to love open-heartedly or not. And when we get to the end of our life, it's all going to add up to the choices we made at every given moment.
Well, I understand your brother coming to you in a dream, and I understand your close relationship with your father, but you've had other experiences with non-relatives, right?
Yes. Yes, I have. So yeah, quite a few of those also.
So why did they come to you?
I don't know. I guess because they were close to me. And it's interesting. Yeah, I can tell you the story of this one close friend of mine who actually came to me at a celebration we were having for him. I had heard that we should wait 10 days after someone passes because the body is more processed then, and the soul of the person or the spirit of the person will be more present. So we had already had Tom's memorial service, but we had heard this news, so we decided that on the 10th day we would have a dinner party and for in honor of him. And so it was just his close friends. So we walked into the party, and there was 12 people in the dining room, and there was 5 people in the kitchen. And I was on the table with the 12 people, and we were telling Tom stories all night, and it was very interesting and entertaining and happy and sad and everything. And then at the very end, Tom's girlfriend, Anne, brings over a little pie. And it's a big crumbly apple pie, so it's only a pie that you can cut into 6 pieces. And she sits down 17 plates in front of me and my friend Deborah, and she said, Deborah bought the dessert. And she puts the pie down, she puts down 17 plates, and we're like, okay, I'm not having pie. And Deborah says, I'm not having pie. And the people all around us said, no, we're not having pie. All the pie is going into the kitchen. And so we started cutting the pie and putting it on a plate, putting a fork on the plate, passing it toward the kitchen, cutting a pie, you know, and just passing plates toward the kitchen, all the while telling stories about Tom. And then all of a sudden, somebody from the kitchen says, we all got pie. And I look around, and everybody at our table had pie, except for Deborah and I. And there was a great big piece of pie that could be cut in half in 2 pieces, still in the pan, that we cut and put on our plates, and we all had pie. And Deborah and I looked at each other and simultaneously said, loaves and fishes. We could not believe it, because we could not believe it. We had just experienced a miracle. Where did that pie come from? It was just incredible. So just then somebody asked me to tell a story about Tom, and I started telling a story, and then I just put my head down on the table and I was laughing. I said, wait a minute, do you guys realize we all got pie? Do you realize what just happened? And the people right around us realized it, and somebody said, oh my God, it's a miracle pie. And just then I saw Tom. I looked up, and kind of to my left, up in the air, there was Tom, and he was taking this kind of white stuff. It's kind of like heavy clouds. It had some thickness to it, but they looked like clouds, and he was just taking this stuff, and he was throwing it into the air and picking it up and throwing it in the air and picking it up and throwing it in the air to tell me that there's plenty in life, that there's always enough. There's more, there's more, there's more. So right when we experienced that miracle pie, Tom showed up, and he just threw that stuff into the air. And I have to tell you that ever since then, I've never worried that I would run out of anything. It's really interesting. That's what I mean. When you experience something on that level and you experience truth on that level, it changes you. So something inside me changed where I didn't worry about running out of money or things or anything anymore. So that was interesting.
Right. Your press kit talks about random messages. You get random messages.
Well, okay. They're not random, actually. They are messages, but they're very connected to the people. Like, for example, my father, you know, who taught me to keep my heart open and love at all times, you know, and that's what I've done ever since then. He was a very spiritual guy. He's the one who turned me on to different meditations when I was young. And he's the one who talked about Christian saints and Indian yogis, and how they both have the same goal, and how the goal of all religion is the same. And I mean, this is how I grew up with my father. So of course my message from him would be to keep my heart open and love at all times, you know, through all things. It wouldn't be about the stock market. So that's why they're not random. They're very specific to that person. my mother, I'll give you another example. She and I had a cat fight relationship. She was an alcoholic and we fought all the time. And I can still hear my father when my mom and I start going at each other. He'd go, "Oh, there they go again," you know, because I would always call her out on her alcoholism, and she never forgot that. And so anyway, we had a really tough life together. Close when she wasn't drinking, but very, very adversarial when she was drinking. So her message to me when she died was about resolve. And of course, it would be something like that. You know, it has to do with my life with my mother. It wouldn't be, again, about some random topic. It would have to do with our life together.
About how?
So they're not really random.
About how many messages have you received from the dead?
Oh, from people who have died. Gosh, I have to count the chapters in my book, because all of them are in my book so far, but now I'm getting more, and so I'll probably have to write another book. So however many chapters are in my book, I don't even know.
Okay.
I can't answer that. Yeah.
A number.
Yes.
And so these come to you in dreams,
mm-hmm.
and you don't ask for them. They just show
Right. up. Right. They're either in dreams or when I go on like a shamanic journey, like I did with a friend took me on a shamanic journey, or like when I saw my father's face in death. You know, this is one important thing. You can see a person's life and death in their face in death, and that's what I realized. And when I learned that when I saw my mother's face in death. I saw all the agony of her alcoholism that she never did conquer. I saw all her graciousness and her love. She was a really incredible woman, but I saw the agony also from the alcoholism. And I saw it in her face and death. I saw her life and her death in her face and death. And that's why when my father died many years later, I needed to see his face, because I realized in seeing her face that you can really see a lot. And I realized also I'm just thinking this right now, that's why you have somebody in a casket and you see their face. That's really interesting. I just now thought of that. You look at that person because you see people staring at that person for a long time. And I think on very deep levels, they're getting a lot of information from that face. You know, I think there's gifts given in that.
Well, you talk about people.
Mm-hmm.
I had a close relationship with Ricky. Ricky was my little poodle.
Oh.
He died when he was 18. And that was very difficult, you know, losing your 18-year companion and everything. You wrote about losing a dog in your book, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you tell about that?
Well, that's a really hard chapter for dog lovers to get through. Dog lovers will say that was the hardest chapter. And you know, when I understand your pain, because I think that the pain of losing an animal is one of the deepest pains, and it's a different pain from a human, because it's truly an unconditional relationship that you have with that dog. It is truly unconditional. And so when you lose that unconditional connection, it's really, really difficult to live without it. It's really hard to get over that. And so, yeah, with Casey, I talked to an animal communicator after Casey died. So what she came to me through another person. And this animal communicator had helped me with other animals before and with Casey. And so I was familiar with her and she was familiar with Casey. And so I talked to her afterward and it was really interesting. It's spelled out in my book, but I had my own experience of Casey's death, of her dying for you know, that the hours before she died and then after she died. And then when I heard Emerald talk to Casey and hear Casey's story, it really collaborated with my experience. It was really, really interesting. Without going into the whole thing, I'll tell you one kind of interesting thing. We had debated about putting her down, and I personally cannot put my dog down. I just can't do it. I don't know. I can't. Other people can, and I respect that, but somehow I can't get myself to do it. And what happened, Casey was listening to all my friends for days saying, you need to put Casey down. You know, dogs hear this stuff. They hear you on the phone talking to your friends. They hear all of this. And so, so at one point, Casey had this huge, seizure, a huge, huge seizure. And I saw her eyes retreat back into her head. She was gone. She was still alive, but she was gone. I saw that. And so I picked up the phone and called the vet. I said, you need to come and put Casey down, because she was never going to come back as Casey. Something else had happened now. And just then, Casey had told me, this is complicated, but anyway, Casey had told me through Emerald that she was going to die in 3 days. And so I was just basically sitting with her for these 3 days, and she had two more days to go. Well, then when this big seizure happened, I called a vet, and I started noticing after about a half an hour, Casey went into this big guttural breathing, the kind of the death breathing, I can't remember what they call it, the death rattle or something. She started going into that breathing, and within another half an hour, she died. And I knew she did that for me. I knew she did. And then she told me later that she forced herself to go, to pass on. She did not want me to go through having put her down. And then when she died, she was, you know, she stopped breathing, her heart stopped, and I was holding her. And then all of a sudden her heart started up again, and she started breathing again. And then there was this big gasp where she then left for good. So that's my side of the story. And Casey's side of the story was how she had started running, started going into the light, and she came back into her body to get more strength to make it on her own. And I just found that really interesting because, you know, Emerald didn't know my side of the story. I just called her right after Casey died. And so Casey told her that story. She came back into her body to get more oxygen or more strength, I think she said, to go out on her own. And boy, that was interesting to me to compare my story to her story. And just also to know that dogs too go into the light, that they're still alive too. You know, it's just reassuring to know that when you read that story.
Well, let's switch now and talk about miracles. I think, if my memory serves me, it doesn't always, I think it was Albert Einstein that said, as far as life goes, you can approach everything as a miracle or nothing as a miracle. And of course, he said, for him, life is a miracle and everything about it. Do you share that philosophy?
Yes, I do. Who was the philosopher who said that?
I thought it was Albert Einstein.
I can see that, yeah. Yeah, he would think it was a miracle, because when you study life on that level, you would have to see it as a miracle. I do win. I'm sure you do too. I consider every moment we live as a miracle, and what I learned with the miracle pie, you know, when Tom died and that 17 people got fed from the six person piece of pie. Miracles take place when you're not even looking, because we weren't looking at that pie. We were telling a story. And I called Deborah later and I said, Deborah, how did that pie come back? Did it all leave the pan? Did we serve it all and it all grew back? Did every piece grow back as we served it? Where did that pie come from? And I realized that miracles come when you're not even looking. And, you know, in life, we're just going about our life. And the miracle that's happening is that we continue to live. We continue to breathe. We continue to love one another. You know, I look around my life every single day and I look at the home I live in. I look at our garden. I look at my dog that I still have. And I look at my partner, Steve, and I look at my friends. I look at all that I have. And believe me, I live in a state of gratitude. And that gratitude is just in my heart, and it goes on all the time because every single thing that's a miracle in life is going on. I think breathing is a miracle. I think the fact that you and I are talking right now is a miracle. Anybody who's listening to us, it's a miracle that they get to hear it. It's a miracle that we get to share this. I believe that everything is a miracle.
Well, now that makes three of us then.
I'm sure. I know you feel that way.
Now, you have a miracle chapter, and you talk about a friend who was in a coma. What would our audience like to know about that?
Oh, yeah, this is important. It's the same miracle pie guy. It's Tom. Tom went into a coma. And I went in to see him one morning because at the same time my boyfriend had died and his family was coming into town. And so I wanted to go spend some time with Tom that morning just by myself before anybody else came into the hospital. So I went into that room and he was in a coma and I went up to him and I went pretty close to his face and I said, Tom, I'm right here. I'm looking at you right now. I'm pretty close to your face. I'm looking into your eyes. Are you in there? Can you hear me? If you can, let me know. And he was holding my hand. He squeezed my hand and he blinked his eyes. And when he blinked his eyes, I went, oh my God, yes, Tom, you're there. I was so excited. And when he blinked his eyes, one of his eyes stayed open just a little tiny bit, a little slit. And I could see in that slit, I could see him smiling. I could see him just loving that I was jumping up and down. You know, you can see people's eyes expression change. I saw that expression change and he was just delighted in the fact that I was jumping up and down over the fact that he could hear me. And so I started talking to him and, you know, just going crazy, telling him everything I could say, you know, and then I'd give him time to rest and I'd go up to his eyes again. I'd say, okay, Tom, I'm here again. And I'd tell him, I'd say something to him and I could see the expression in his eye. So I was with him for maybe 45 minutes and then other people started coming into the room and his girlfriend and other people. And then at one point I had to leave. So I go up to him again. And I go to the other side of the bed where people are not there. And I go to the slit eye. You know, I'm on the side of the bed where his eye is slit open. And I say to him, everybody's talking in the room, so I can just say all my goodbyes to him, my thank yous to him. I thanked him for being such a wonderful friend. I just said everything I wanted to say to him and that I hoped I saw him again soon and, you know, Godspeed and everything. And as I was talking to him, when that little slit filled up with tears. It was so moving. And so this is what I want people to know. They should say whatever, they should just talk naturally to the people in a coma because Tom heard everything I told him about when I was excited and telling him all the news, he heard all of that. And when I thanked him and told him everything I wanted to say to him, his eyes filled up with tears just like we would in real life. So the person in a coma is in there, and they hear everything that you're saying.
There was a French publisher that wrote a book. I think it was something like The Bell and the Butterfly or something along those terms. But he went into a coma, and it was a locked-in situation. In other words, he could hear and understand everything that was going on around him in his environment, but he couldn't move or talk. And he was locked into that situation. Interesting thing was, well, how do you know if somebody is in that situation? They can hear you and everything. In his particular case, there was one muscle that he could move, and that was one of his eyelids. And he and his personal assistant got a scheme going where he wrote the book by blinking his eyes.
Oh, wow.
It's a, and they made a movie out of it. It's a great story in case anybody wants to research it and check it out. But sometimes...
Oh, I do.
They're in there.
They are in there. And that's the point that people need to know. They are in there. You know, this is interesting that you said that about a book and a movie, because the day before, when Tom was in a coma, we had this psychic woman. It was a friend of Tom's, but she's also psychic. And a bunch of us were sitting in there with Tom. And she was saying, oh, there's a silver cord, and Tom's here, and this is what he's feeling, this is what he's doing. And you know what? If I had known this was going to happen that day, I would have said to Tom, was everything she said true? If so, blink your eyes. You know, I would have loved to have known if everything she said was true, because it was quite interesting, all the things that she was saying. But yeah, I can see that, because I wish I had asked, if I had had my bearings, in a sense, I would have asked Tom a whole bunch of questions, you know, but I kind of ran out of time. I had to leave. But the next time, if I'm ever with somebody in a coma, I'm going to ask them questions and have them blink their eyelids, because Tom could also blink his eyelids. So maybe that's a thing with a coma. Maybe there's not muscles in there that are affected by the coma or something. That's really interesting.
I don't know, but it's an interesting story.
Oh, yeah.
So your book is called Light in the Morning,
mm-hmm.
Memoirs of an Undertaker's Daughter. It's a great book, a great read. And
thank you.
Tell my audience how they can get a copy or communicate with you.
They can go to Amazon and get Light in the Morning, M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, Memoirs of an Undertaker's Daughter, or they can go to my website, lightinthemorning.com. And they, you know, they can find my book there. There's podcasts, there's reviews, there's a lot. It's in the works, but it's already started. It'll keep growing. They can add their name to my email list if they would like, and find out about my next book, you know, when that comes out. The first book took me 12 years, so I don't know how many years this next book is going to take, because as you said, I'm a realtor also. And so I don't have a lot of time to write, and that other one took, the first one took me a long time.
I'm writing my 45th book right now, and I'm really close to getting ready to do the formatting on the manuscript. I have a proposed title. My last and most important book was called Freedom from Addiction 3. And this one I was thinking about titling Freedom from Addiction, The Final Message. What do you think about
that? Oh, I like that. I like that a lot. I like that a lot. How many, you've got three books, Freedom of Addiction, and then this would be the final.
Now, this is, unless something happens to me or the world where I've got something new to say about it, I've said it all. And so
I like final. I like that title.
I was thinking the final message.
Yeah. No, I like it. Final message. I like that a lot. I think that's a wonderful title.
But if you can't wait to get it, get from Amazon, get Freedom from Addiction 3. If you can wait, I'm giving you around three more addictions that you may or may not understand to be addictions, but a little heads up on that.
Oh, good. I will definitely get it. I want the whole thing.
One of them is the addiction to racism. And
interesting.
I think considering what the world's going through, if you're addicted to racism, it is just as significant as if you were an alcoholic or some other kind of addiction that you have heard about. So that's what I'm doing.
I think that's wonderful. Now I'm getting a flavor of all the different addictions, and I think that's incredible because everybody's probably going to have something in there that they can relate to, and realize that they just have to get to a point of just pure love, of real love, and real gratitude, and real appreciation, and get away from all of those judgments and all of the I want to read it. I can tell just by who you are in this interview how interesting and how deep your book would go. I'm definitely going to get it. I might not be able to wait. I'm going to have to get the third one. And I'll also get the final one.
My definition of addiction is if you have a behavior, any behavior, that you find is hurting you, whether it be physically, emotionally, philosophically, spiritually, if it's hurting you, or if your addiction is hurting someone you love, and if you can't stop it, then you're addicted to it. And since nobody that's mentally sound has a good reason to want to hurt themselves or their loved ones, that's when you need treatment, and that's what I've been doing, and that's what you can get from reading my work and everything.
Oh, that's wonderful. And do you offer solutions in the book, or is it a type of meditation, or is it all different, each one, or what?
The book is set up in two halves. The first mm-hmm. half tells you how you get to wanting to do a program to get rid of your addiction. It tells you the beliefs and the reasons and all kind of background information. And then about halfway through the book, there's a specific program, and it lays it out where anybody can do it on their own if they're motivated to do it. Some people can't, and so therefore I provide personal services for those people that need additional help. And my website is RevWynHendersonMD.com. And you can go over there and find out what you can do if you need more help. But it's all in the book. And
wonderful. Wow.
So, well, it's been a
wow
talking with you today, Margot, and I hope people will go out and get a copy of your book, Light in the Morning. And you've got another book you're going to be working on?
Yes, I do. I had two dogs, and I lost another dog in April, and it's been quite a journey. And she started coming to me in dreams, and she has lots of messages. And I said, should I write it in a book? And she says, yes, I've got a lot to say. And so she wasn't a normal dog, I found out, through messages from three different animal communicators and from her. It turns out do you know what a bodhisattva is?
No, I don't.
A bodhisattva is someone who comes in enlightened, is my understanding, somebody who comes into this world enlightened to help people, and they leave enlightened, but they come for very specific purposes. And so she was a really special dog. Everyone just had extra love for her. She was really, they just would go spend time with her and everything. And And it turns out there's a whole understanding why all these people had to spend time with her. She really came to this planet to help people, and she had to leave at a very specific time to help people. But she said, yes, I have a lot to say, and she's already given me all kinds of things. And so I probably am becoming a channel for her. Now that our whole conversation has come around, I think that was your first question to me. But yeah, I guess that is becoming a channel for her, because I was going to write a book, and my working title, and I don't know, I'll see what you think of this, is called Ascension, My Talks with Bindi. That's the name of my dog. You know, what do you think of that?
Well, that's a good title. I don't know if there might be a better title. One thing I could suggest that I've done in the past is I've brainstormed and got maybe five titles.
Mm-hmm.
And then I put that question in front of a focus group, and I asked them, of these five titles, which of these titles would most inspire you to buy the book? And it wasn't always what I thought. Some of my titles that I liked got trashed. So you might try that as you're writing this book. And when you get it written, let's come back and do another program.
I would love that, Wynn. Thanks for that advice. And I've really enjoyed talking to you. And thank you so much for having me on. I look forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks, Margo.
You're welcome. Thank you.